wall near the doorway, he peered out through a screen of hanging duck carcasses. Two men entered the street no more than a second later, walking close together, glancing quickly from side to side. Every working man in Paris carried the marks of his trade upon his person, and it didn't take much of a nose to detect the whiff of sea salt on these two. If the small gold hoop in the shorter man's ear hadn't been a dead giveaway, the deep reddish brown of their faces would have made it clear they were deep-water sailors. Accustomed to the cramped quarters of shipboard and quay taverns, seamen seldom walked in a straight line. These two slid through the crowded alleys like eels through rocks, eyes flicking past beggars, serving maids, housewives, merchants, seawolves assessing potential prey.
"I let them get well past the shop," Jamie explained, "and I was just about to step out and go back the other way, when I saw another of them at the mouth of the alley."
This man wore the same uniform as the other two, side locks heavily coated with grease, a fish knife at his side, and a marlin spike the length of a man's forearm thrust through his belt. Short and thick-set, the man stood still at the end of the alley, holding his ground against the buffeting waves of commerce that ebbed and flowed through the narrow passage. Clearly, he had been left on guard while his fellows quested ahead.
"So I was left wondering what best to do," Jamie said, rubbing his nose. "I was safe enough where I was, but there was no back way from the shop, and the moment I stepped from the doorway, I'd be seen."
He glanced down reflectively, smoothing the crimson fabric of his kilt across his thigh. An enormous red barbarian was going to be conspicuous no matter how thick the crowd.
"So what did you do?" I asked.
Fergus, ignoring the conversation, was stuffing his pockets methodically with cakes, pausing for a hasty bite ever so often in the process. Jamie caught my glance at the boy and shrugged.
"He'll not have been in the habit of eating regularly," he said. "Let him be."
"All right," I said, "but go on. What did you do?"
"Bought a sausage," he said promptly.
"A Dunedin, to be exact. Made of spiced duck, ham and venison, boiled, stuffed and sun-dried. A Dunedin sausage measured 18 inches from end to end and was as hard as seasoned oak wood."
"I couldn't step out with my sword drawn," Jamie explained, "but I didn't like the idea of stepping past the fellow in the alleyway with no one at my back and empty hands."
Bearing the Dunedin at port arms and keeping a weather eye on the passing crowd, Jamie had stepped boldly down the alley toward the watcher at its mouth. The man had met his gaze quite calmly, showing no sign of any malign intent. Jamie might have thought his original premonition mistaken had he not seen the watcher's eyes flick briefly to something over Jamie's shoulder. Obeying the instincts that had kept him alive thus far, he had dived forward, knocking the watcher down and sliding on his face across the filthy cobbles of the street. The crowd scattered before him with shrieks of alarm, and he rolled to his feet to see the flung knife that had missed him, quivering in the boards of a ribbon stall.
"If I'd had a bit of doubt it was me they wanted, I didn't fret about it longer," he said dryly.
He had kept hold of the sausage, and now found use for it, swinging it smartly across the face of one attacker.
"I broke his nose, I think," he said meditatively. "Anyway, he reeled back, and I shoved past him and took off running down the Rue Pelletier."
The inhabitants of the street scattered before him like geese, startled by the sight of a hurtling Scotsman, kilt flying around his churning knees. He didn't stop to look behind. By the shouts of indignant passers-by, he could tell that the assailants were still in pursuit. This part of the city was seldom patrolled by the King's Guard, and the crowd itself offered little protection other than a simple obstruction that might slow his pursuers. No one was likely to interfere in a matter of violence on a foreigner's behalf.
"There are no alleys off the Rue Pelletier. I needed at least to get to a place where I could draw my sword and have a wall at my back," Jamie explained. "So I pushed at the doors as I passed, till I hit one that opened."
Dashing into a gloomy hallway, past a startled porter, and through a hanging drape, he had shot into the centre of a large, well-lighted room, and come to a screeching halt in the middle of one Madame Elise's salon, the scent of perfume heavy in his nostrils.
"I see," I said, biting my lip. "I trust you didn't draw your sword in there."
Jamie narrowed his eyes at me, but didn't deign to reply directly.
"I'll leave it to you, Sassenach," he said dryly, "to imagine what it feels like to arrive unexpectedly in the midst of a brothel in possession of a very large sausage."
My imagination proved fully equal to this task, and I burst out laughing. "God, I wish I could have seen you," I said.
"Thank God you didn't,"
he said fervently. A furious blush glowed on his cheekbones. Ignoring remarks from the fascinated inmates, Jamie had made his way awkwardly through what he described, shuddering, as
tangles of bare limbs,
until he had spotted Fergus against one wall, regarding the intruder with a round-eyed astonishment. Seizing upon this unexpected manifestation of maleness, Jamie had gripped the lad by the shoulder and fervently implored him to show the way to the nearest exit without loss of a moment.
"I could hear a hurly-burly breaking out in the hallway," he explained, "and I kent they were in after me. I didn't want to be having to fight for my life wi' a lot of naked women getting in the way."
"I can see that the prospect might be daunting," I agreed, rubbing my upper lip. "But obviously he got you out."
"Aye, he didna hesitate a moment, the dear lad. 'This way, monsieur,' he says, and it was up the stair and through a room and out a window onto the roof, and away with us both."
Jamie cast a fond glance at his new employee. "You know," I observed, "there are some wives who wouldn't believe one word of a story like that." Jamie's eyes opened wide in astonishment.
"They wouldn't? Why ever not?"
"Possibly," I said dryly, "because they aren't married to you. I'm pleased that you escaped with your virtue intact. But for the moment, I'm rather more interested in the chaps who chased you in there."
"I didn't have a great deal of leisure to think about it at the time," Jamie replied. "And now that I have, I still couldna see who they were or why they were hunting me."
"Robbery, do you think?"
The cash receipts of the wine business were conveyed between the Fraser warehouse, the Rue Trémoulin, and Jared's bank by strongbox, under heavy guard. Still, Jamie was very visible among the crowds near the river docks, and was undoubtedly known to be a wealthy foreign merchant. Wealthy, by contrast, with most of the denizens of that neighbourhood at any rate. He shook his head, flicking crumbs of dried mud off his shirt front.
"That might be, I suppose. But they didn't try to accost me. It was straight out murder they meant."
His tone was quite matter-of-fact, but it gave me rather a wobbly feeling in the knees, and I sank down onto a settee. I licked my lips, gone suddenly dry.
Who do you think?"
He shrugged, frowning, as he scooped up a dab of icing from the plate and licked it off his finger.
"The only man I could think of who's threatened me is the Comte Saint-Germain, but I can't think what he'd gain from having me killed."
"He's Jared's business rival, you said?"
"Oh, aye. But the Comte's no interest in German wines, and I can't see him going to the trouble of killing me, only to ruin Jared's new enterprise by bringing him back to Paris." "That seems a trifle extreme," he said dryly, "even for a man with the Comte's temper."
"Well, do you think—"
The idea made me mildly ill, and I swallowed twice before going on.
"Do you think it might have been revenge for the Patagonia being burned?"
Jamie shook his head, baffled.
"I suppose it could be, but it seems a long time to wait." "And why me come to that?" he added. "It's you annoyed him, Sassenach. Why not kill you, if that's what he meant?"
The sick feeling got slightly worse.
"Do you have to be so bloody logical?" I said.
He saw the look on my face and smiled suddenly, putting an arm around me for comfort.
Nay, Modunia, the Comte's a quick temper, but I can't see him going to the trouble and expense of killing either of us, only for revenge. If it might get him his ship back, then yes, he added. But as it is, I expect he'd only think the price of 3 hired assassins throwing good money after bad.
He patted my shoulder and stood up.
Nay, I expect it was only a triad of robbery after all. Don't trouble yourself about it. I'll take Myrtle with me to the docks from now on, to be safe.
He stretched himself and brushed the last of the crumbling dirt from his kilt.
Am I decent to go into supper? He asked, looking critically down his chest. It must be nearly ready by now.
What's ready? He opened the door, and a rich, spicy scent wafted up at once from the dining room below.
Why, the sausage, of course, he said, with a grin over one shoulder. You didn't think I'd let it go to waste.
Chapter 13 Deceptions. Barberry leaves, 3 handfuls in a decoction, steeped overnight, poured over half a handful of black hellebore. I laid the list of ingredients down on the inlaid table as though it was slightly slimy to the touch. I got it from Madame Rouleau. She's the best of the angel makers, but even she says it's dangerous. Louise, are you sure you want to do this? Her round pink face was blotched, and the plump lower lip had a tendency to quiver. What choice do I have? She picked up the recipe for the abortifacient and gazed at it in repulsed fascination. Black hellebore, she said, and shuddered. The very name of it sounds evil.
Well, it's bloody nasty stuff, I said bluntly. It will make you feel as though your insides are coming out. But the baby may come too.
It doesn't always work. I remembered Master Raymond's warning.
It is dangerous to wait too long,
and wondered how far gone she might be.
Surely no more than 6 weeks or so.
She had told me the instant she suspected. She glanced at me, startled, with red-rimmed eyes. You've used it yourself?
God, no!
I startled myself with the vehemence of my exclamation and took a deep breath. No, I've seen women who have, though, at l'Hôpital des Anges. The abortionists, the angel-makers, practiced largely in the privacy of homes, their own or their clients. Their successes were not the ones that came to the hospital. I laid a hand unobtrusively over my own abdomen, as though for protection of its helpless occupant. Louise caught the gesture and hurled herself onto the sofa, burying her head in her hands.
Oh, I wish I were dead, she moaned. Why couldn't I be as fortunate as you, to be bearing the child of a husband I loved?
She clutched her own plump stomach with both hands, staring down at it as though expecting the child to peek out between her fingers. There were any number of answers to that particular question, but I didn't think she really wanted to hear any of them. I took a deep breath and sat down beside her, patting a heaving damask shoulder.
Louise, I said, do you want the child?
She lifted her head and stared at me in astonishment.
But of course I want it, she exclaimed. It's his. It's Charles. It's...
Her face crumpled, and she bowed her head once more over her hands, clasped so tightly over her belly.
It's mine, she whispered.
After a long moment, she raised her streaming face, and with a pathetic attempt to pull herself together, wiped her nose on a trailing sleeve.
But it's no good, she said.
If I don't... She glanced at the recipe on the table and swallowed heavily.
Then Jules will divorce me. He'll cast me out. It would be the most terrible scandal. I might be excommunicated. Not even father could protect me.
Yes, I said.
But I hesitated, then cast caution to the winds. Is there any chance Jules might be convinced the child is his? I asked bluntly. She looked blank for a moment, and I wanted to shake her.
I don't see how, unless... Oh!
Light dawned, and she looked at me, horrified.
Sleep with Jules, you mean? But Charles would be furious.
Charles, I said through my teeth, is not pregnant.
Well, but he's... That is... I couldn't.
The look of horror was fading, though, being slowly replaced with a growing realization of possibility. I didn't want to push her. Still, I saw no good reason for her to risk her life for the sake of Charles Stewart's pride, either. Do you suppose Charles would want you to endanger yourself? I said. For that matter, does he know about the child? She nodded, mouth slightly open as she thought about it, hands still clenched together over her stomach.
Yes, that's what we quarrelled about last time, she sniffed. He was angry. He said it was all my fault, that I should have waited until he had reclaimed his father's throne. Then he would be king some day, and he could come and take me away from Jules and have the Pope annul my marriage, and his son could be heirs to England and Scotland.
She gave way once more, snivelling and wailing incoherently into a fold of her skirt. I rolled my eyes in exasperation.
Oh, do be quiet, Louise, I snapped.
It shocked her enough to make her stop weeping, at least momentarily. And I took advantage of the hiatus to press my point.
Look,
I said, as persuasively as possible. You don't suppose Charles would want you to sacrifice his son, do you? Legitimate or not? Actually, I rather thought Charles would be in favour of any step that removed inconvenience from his own path, regardless of the effects on Louise or his putative offspring. On the other hand, the prince did have a marked streak of romanticism. Perhaps he could be induced to view this as a sort of temporary adversity common to exiled monarchs. Obviously, I was going to need Jamie's help. I grimaced at the thought of what he was likely to say about it.
Well...
Louise was wavering, wanting desperately to be convinced. I had a momentary pang of pity for Jules, Prince de Rouen, but the vision of a young servant girl dying in protracted, blood-smeared agony on a pallet spread in the stone hallway of l'Hôpital des Anges was brutally clear in my mind. It was nearly sunset when I left the de Rouen's, footsteps dragging. Louise, palpitating with nervousness, was upstairs in her boudoir, her maid putting up her hair and arraying her in her most daring gown before she went down to a private supper with her husband. I felt completely drained, and hoped that Jamie hadn't brought anyone home for supper. I could use a spot of privacy, too. He hadn't. When I entered the study, he was seated at the desk, poring over three or four sheets of close-written paper.
"Do you think the fair merchant is more likely to be Louis of France or his minister Duvernay?" he asked without looking up.
"Fine, thank you, darling, and how are you?" I said.
"All right," he said absently.
The cowlicks on the top of his head were sticking up straight. He massaged his scalp vigorously as I watched, scowling down his long nose at the paper.
"I'm sure the tailor from Vendôme must be Monsieur Gilles," he said, running a finger along the lines of the letter. "And our mutual friend, that could be either the Earl of Mar or possibly the papal envoy.
I think the Earl from the rest of it, but the... What on earth is that?" I peered over his shoulder and gasped when I saw the signature at the foot of the letter. "James Stewart, by the grace of God, King of England and Scotland."
Bloody Christ, it worked then!
Swinging around, I spotted Fergus crouched on a stool in front of the fire, industriously stuffing pastries into his face.
"Good lad," I said, smiling at him.
He grinned back at me, cheeks puffed like a chipmunk's with chestnut tart.
"We got it from the people messenger,"
Jamie explained, coming to the surface long enough to realise I was there.
"Fergus took it from the bag while he was eating supper in a tavern. He'll spend the night there, so we'll have to put this back before morning. No difficulties there, Fergus."
The boy swallowed and shook his head.
No, my lord. He sleeps alone, not trusting his bedmates not to steal the contents of his bag.
He grinned derisively at this.
The second window on the left above the stables.
He waved an airy hand, the deft, grubby fingers reaching for another pie.
It is nothing, my lord.
I had a sudden vision of that fine-boned hand held squirming on a block, with an executioner's blade raised above the broomstick wrist. I gulped, forcing down the sudden lurch of my stomach. Fergus wore a small greenish copper medal on a string about his neck. The image of St. Dismas, I hoped.
Well, I said, taking a deep breath to steady myself, what's all this about fur merchants?
There was no time then for leisurely inspection. In the end, I made a quick, fair copy of the letter, and the original was carefully refolded and its original seal replaced with the aid of a knife blade heated in a candle flame. Watching this operation critically, Fergus shook his head at Jamie.
You have the touch, my lord. It is a pity that the one hand is crippled.
Jamie gazed dispassionately at his right hand. It really wasn't too bad. A couple of fingers set slightly askew, a thick scar down the length of the middle finger. The only major damage had been to the fourth finger, which stuck out stiffly, its second joint so badly crushed that the healing had fused two finger bones together. The hand had been broken in Wentworth Prison less than 4 months ago by Jack Randall.
Never mind, he said, smiling.
He flexed the hand and flicked the fingers playfully at Fergus.
My great paws are too big to make a living picking pockets, anyway.
He had regained an astounding degree of movement, I thought. He still carried the soft ball of rags I had made for him, squeezing it unobtrusively hundreds of times a day as he went about his business. And if the knitting bones hurt him, he never complained.
Off with you, then, he told Fergus. Come and find me when you're safe back, so I'll know you haven't been taken up by the police or the landlord of the tavern.
Fergus wrinkled his nose scornfully at such an idea, but nodded, tucking the letter carefully inside his smock before disappearing down the back stair toward the night that was both natural element and protection for him. Jamie looked after him for a long minute, then turned to me. He truly looked at me for the first time, and his brows flew up.
"Christ, Sassenach," he said. "You're as pale as my sark. Are you all right?"
"Just hungry," I said.
He rang at once for supper, and we ate it before the fire while I told him about Louise. Rather to my surprise, while he knit his brows over the situation and muttered uncomplimentary things under his breath in Gaelic about both Louise and Charles Stuart, he agreed with my solution to the problem.
"I thought you'd be upset," I said,
scooping up a mouthful of succulent cassoulet with a bit of bread. The warm, bacon-spiced beans soothed me, filling me with a sense of peaceful well-being. It was cold and dark outside, and loud with the rushing of the wind, but it was warm and quiet here by the fire together.
"Oh, about Louise de la Tour foisting a bastard on her husband."
Jamie frowned at his own dish, running a finger around the edge to pick up the last of the juice.
"Well, I'm no very much in favour of it, I'll tell you, Sassenach. It's a filthy trick to play on a man. But what's the poor bloody woman to do otherwise?"
He shook his head, and then glanced at the desk across the room, and smiled wryly.
"Besides, it doesn't become me to be taking a high moral stand about other people's behaviour. Stealing letters and spying and trying generally to subvert a man my family holds as king. I shouldn't have liked to have someone judging me on the grounds of the things I'm doing, Sassenach."
"You have a damn good reason for what you're doing," I objected.
He shrugged. The firelight flickering on his face hollowed his cheeks and threw shadows into the orbits of his eyes. Made him look older than he was. I tended to forget that he was not quite 24.
"Aye, well, and Louise de la Tour has a reason too," he said. She wants to save one life. I want 10,000. Does that excuse my risking wee Fergus and Jared's business? And you?
He turned his head and smiled at me, the light gleaming from the long, straight bridge of his nose, glowing like sapphire in the one eye turned toward the fire.
Nay, I think I will na lose my sleep over the need for opening another man's letters, he said. It may come to much worse than that before we've done, Clare. And I canna say ahead of time what my conscience will stand. It's best not to test it too soon.
There was nothing to be said to that. It was all true. I reached out and laid my hand against his cheek. He laid his own hand over mine, cradling it for a moment, then turned his head and gently kissed my palm.
Well, he said,
drawing a deep breath and returning to business.
Now that we've eaten, shall we have a look at this letter?
The letter was coded, that much was obvious. To foil possible interceptors, Jamie explained.
Who would want to intercept His Majesty's mail? I asked. Besides us, I mean.
Jamie snorted with amusement at my naivete.
Almost anyone, Sassenach. Louis spies, Duvernay's spies, Philip of Spain's spies. The Jacobite lords and the ones who think they might turn Jacobite if the wind sets right. Dealers in information who dinna care a fart in a breeze who lives or dies by it. The Pope himself. The Holy See's been supporting the Stuarts in exile for 50 years. I imagine he keeps an eye on what they're doing.
He tapped a finger on the copy I'd made of James's letter to his son.
The seal on this letter had been removed maybe 3 times before I took it off myself, he said.
I see, I said. No wonder James codes his letters. Do you think you can make out what he says? Jamie picked up the sheets, frowning.
I don't know. Some, yes. Some other things, I've no idea. I think perhaps I can work it out, though, if I can see some other letters King James has sent. See what Fergus can do for me there.
He folded the copy and put it carefully away in a drawer, which he locked.
You canna trust anyone, Sassenach,
he explained, seeing my eyes widen.
We might easily have spies among the servants.
He dropped the small key in the pocket of his coat and held out his arm to me. I took the candle in one hand and his arm in the other, and we turned toward the stairs. The rest of the house was dark, the servants, all but Fergus, virtuously asleep. I felt a trifle creepy with the realization that one or more of the silent sleepers below or above might not be what they seemed.
"Doesn't it make you feel a bit nervous?" I asked as we went up the stairs.
"Never being able to trust anyone?" He laughed softly.
"Well, I wouldn't say anyone, Sassenach. There's you, and Myrto, and my sister Jenny, and her husband Ian. I'd trust the four of you with my life. I have, for that matter, more than once."
I shivered as he pulled back the drapes of the big bed. The fire had been banked for the night, and the room was growing cold.
4 people you can trust doesn't seem like all that many," I said, unlacing my gown.
He pulled his shirt over his head and tossed it on the chair. The scars on his back shone silver in the faint light from the night sky outside.
"Aye, well," he said, matter-of-factly, "it's 4 more than Charles Stuart has."
There was a bird singing outside, though it was long before first light. A mockingbird, practising his trills and runs over and over, perched on a rain gutter somewhere in the dark nearby. Moving sleepily, Jamie rubbed his cheek against the smooth skin of my freshly waxed underarm, then turned his head and planted a soft kiss in the warm hollow that sent a small delicious shudder down my side.
He murmured, running a light hand over my ribs. I like it when you come out all goose-flesh like that, Sassenach. Like this, I answered, running the nails of my right hand gently over the skin of his back, which obligingly rippled into goosebumps under the teasing of the touch.
Ah, yourself, then, I answered softly, doing it some more.
With a luxurious groan, he rolled to the side, wrapping his arms around me as I followed, enjoying the sudden contact of every inch of our naked skins, all down the front, from head to toe. He was warm as a smothered fire, the heat of him safely banked for the night, to kindle again to a blaze in the black cold of dawn. His lips fastened gently on one nipple, and I groaned myself, arching slightly to encourage him to take it deeper into the warmth of his mouth. My breasts were growing fuller and more sensitive by the day. My nipples ached and tingled sometimes under the tight binding of my gowns, wanting to be suckled.
"Will you let me do this later?" he murmured with a soft bite. "When the child's come and your breasts fill wi' milk. Will you feed me too, then, next to your heart?"
I clasped his head and cradled it, fingers deep in the baby soft hair that grew thick at the base of his skull. "Always," I whispered. Chapter 14. Meditations on the Flesh. Fergus was more than adept at his profession, and nearly every day brought in a new selection of His Highness's correspondence. Sometimes I was hard-pressed to copy everything before Fergus's next expedition, when he would replace the items abstracted before stealing the new letters. Some of these were further coded communications from King James in Rome. Jamie put aside the copies of these to puzzle over at leisure. The bulk of His Highness's correspondence was innocuous. Notes from friends in Italy, an increasing number of bills from local merchants. Charles had a taste for gaudy clothing and fine boots, as well as for brandy wine, and the occasional note from Louise de la Tour de Rouen. These were fairly easy to pick out, aside from the tiny, mannered handwriting she employed that made her letters look as though a small bird had been making tracks on them. She invariably saturated the paper with her trademark hyacinth scent. Jamie resolutely refused to read these.
"I willna be reading the man's love letters," he said firmly. "Even a plotter must scruple at something."
He sneezed and dropped the latest missive back into Fergus's pocket.
"Besides," he added more practically, "Louise tells you everything anyway."
This was true. Louise had become a close friend, and spent nearly as much time in my drawing-room as she did in her own, wringing her hands over Charles, then forgetting him in the fascination of discussing the marvels of pregnancy. She never had morning sickness, curse her. Scatterbrained as she was, I liked her very much. Still, it was a great relief to escape from her company to l'Hôpital des Anges every afternoon. While Louise was unlikely ever to set foot within l'Hôpital des Anges, I wasn't without company when I went there. Undaunted by her first exposure to the hôpital, Mary Hawkins summoned up the courage to accompany me again. And yet again. While she couldn't quite bring herself to look directly at a wound yet, she was useful at spooning gruel into people and sweeping floors. Apparently she considered these activities a welcome change from either the gatherings of the court or the life at her uncle's house. While she was frequently shocked at some of the behaviour she saw at court, not that she saw much, but she was easily shocked, she didn't betray any particular distaste or horror at the sight of the Vicomte Marigny, which led me to conclude that her wretched family had not yet completed the negotiations for her marriage, and therefore hadn't told her about it. This conclusion was borne out one day in late April, when, en route to l'Hôpital des Anges, she blushingly confided to me that she was in love. "Oh, he's so handsome," she enthused, her stammer entirely forgotten, "and so, well, so spiritual as well." Spiritual, I said. Yes, very nice. Privately, I thought that that particular quality wasn't one which would have topped my own list of desirable attributes in a lover, but then tastes differed. And who is the favoured gentleman, then? I teased gently. Anyone I know? The rosy blush deepened. No, I shouldn't think so. She looked up then, eyes sparkling. But, oh, I shouldn't tell you this, but I can't help myself. He wrote to my father. He's coming back to Paris next week. Really? This was interesting news. I'd heard that the Comte de Pal is expected at court next week, I said. Is your, intended one of his party? Mary looked aghast at the suggestion. A Frenchman? Oh, no, Claire. Really, how could I marry a Frenchman? Is there something wrong with Frenchmen? I asked, rather surprised at her vehemence. You do speak French, after all. Perhaps that was the trouble, though. While Mary did speak French very nicely, her shyness made her stammering even worse in that language than in English. I had come across a couple of kitchen boys only the day before, entertaining each other with cruel imitations of La petite anglaise maladroite. You don't know about Frenchmen? She whispered, eyes wide and horrified. Oh, but of course you wouldn't. Your husband is so gentle and so kind. He wouldn't... I mean, I know he doesn't trouble you that way. Her face was suffused with a rich peony that reached from chin to hairline, and the stammer was about to strangle her. Do you mean... I began, trying to think of some tactful way of extricating her without entangling myself in speculations about the habits of Frenchmen. However, considering what Mr. Hawkins had told me about Mary's father and his plans for her marriage, I rather thought perhaps I should try to disabuse her of the notions that she had clearly picked up from the gossip of salon and dressing room. I didn't want her to die of fright if she did end up married to a Frenchman. What they do in bed, she whispered hoarsely. Well, I said matter-of-factly, there are only so many things you can do in bed with a man, after all. And since I see quite a large number of children about the city, I'd assume that even Frenchmen are fairly well versed in the orthodox methods. Oh, children. Well, yes, of course, she said vaguely, as though not seeing much connection. But they said... She cast her eyes down, embarrassed, and her voice sank even lower. That he... A Frenchman's thing, you know. Yes, I know, I said, striving for patience. So far as I know, they're much like any other man's. Englishmen and Scotsmen are quite similarly endowed. Yes, but they put it between a lady's legs. I mean... Right up inside her. This bit of stop press news finally out, she took a deep breath, which seemed to steady her, for the violent crimson of her face receded slightly. An Englishman, or even a Scot? Oh, I didn't mean it that way. Her hand flew to her mouth in embarrassment. But a decent man like your husband, surely he would... Never dream of forcing a wife to endure something like that. I placed a hand on my slightly bloated stomach and regarded her thoughtfully. I began to see why spirituality ranked so highly in Mary Hawkins' catalogue of manly virtues. Mary, I said, I think we must have a small talk. I was still smiling privately to myself when I walked out into the great hall of the hôpital, my own dress covered with the drab, sturdy fabric of a novice's habit. A good many of the chirurgiens, urinoscopists, bone-setters, physicians, and other healers were donating their time and services as a charity. Others came to learn or refine their skills. The hapless patients of l'Hôpital des Anges were in no position to protest being the subjects of assorted medical experiments. Aside from the nuns themselves, the medical staff changed almost daily, depending upon who found themselves without paying patients that day, or who had a new technique that needed trial. Still, most of the freelance medicos came often enough that I learned to recognise the regulars in short order. One of the most interesting was the tall, gaunt man whom I'd seen amputating a leg on my first visit to the hôpital. Upon inquiry, I determined that his name was Monsieur Foret. Primarily a bone-setter, occasionally he would attempt the trickier types of amputation, particularly when a whole limb rather than a joint was involved. The nuns and orderlies seemed a bit in awe of Monsieur Foret. They never chaffed him or exchanged rude jokes, as they did with most of the other volunteer medical help. Monsieur Foret was at work today. I approached quietly to see what he was doing. The patient, a young workman, lay white-faced and gasping on a pallet. He had fallen from the scaffolding on the cathedral, always under construction, and broken both an arm and a leg. I could see that the arm was no particular challenge to a professional bone-setter, only a simple fracture of the radius. The leg, though, was something else, an impressive double-compound fracture, involving both the mid-femur and the tibia. Sharp bone fragments protruded through the skin of both thigh and shin, and the lacerated flesh was blue with traumatic bruising over most of the upper aspects of the leg. I didn't wish to distract the bone-setter's attention to his case, but Monsieur Foret appeared sunk in thought, slowly circling the patient, sidling back and forth like a large carrion crow, cautious, lest the victim not be really dead yet. He did look rather like a crow, I thought, with that prominent beak of a nose and the smooth black hair that he wore unpowdered, slicked back to a wispy knot at the nape of his neck. His clothes, too, were black and sombre, though of good quality. Evidently he had a profitable practice outside the hôpital. At last, deciding on his course of action, Monsieur Foret lifted his chin from his hand and glanced around for assistance. His eyes lighted on me and he beckoned me forward. I was dressed in a coarse linen novice's gown, and lost in his concentration, he didn't notice that I didn't wear the wimple and veil of a nursing sister. "Here, masseur," he directed, taking hold of the patient's ankle. "Grasp it tightly just behind the heel. Do not apply pressure until I tell you, but when I give the word, draw the foot directly toward you. Pull very slowly, but with force. It will take considerable strength, you understand."
"I understand." I grasped the foot as directed, while Monsieur Foret made his slow and gangling way toward the other end of the pallet, glancing contemplatively at the fractured leg.
"I have a stimulant here to assist," he said,
drawing a small vial out of his coat pocket and setting it beside the patient's head.
"It constricts the blood vessels of the surface skin and drives the blood inward, where it may be of more use to our young friend."
So speaking, he grasped the patient by the hair and thrust the vial into the young man's mouth, skilfully decanting the medicine down his throat without spilling a drop.
"Ah," he said approvingly, as the man gulped and breathed deeply. "That will help. Now, as to the pain. Yes, it is better if we can numb the leg, so he will be less inclined to resist our efforts as we straighten it."
He reached into his capacious pocket once more, this time coming out with a small brass pin, some 3 inches in length, with a wide, flat head. One bony, thick-jointed hand tenderly explored the inside of the patient's thigh near the groin, following the thin blue line of a large vein beneath the skin. The groping fingers hesitated, paused, palpated in a small circle, then settled on a point. Digging a sharp forefinger into the skin as though to mark his place, Monsieur Foret brought the point of the brass pin to bear in the same place. Another quick reach into the pocket of marvels produced a small brass hammer, with which he drove the pin straight into the leg with one blow. The leg twitched violently,
then seemed to relax into limpness. The vasoconstrictor administered earlier did, in fact, seem to be working. The ooze of blood from the severed tissues was markedly less.
"That's amazing," I exclaimed. "What did you do?"
Monsieur Fauré smiled shyly, a faint rosiness staining his blue-shadowed cheeks with pleasure at my admiration.
"Well, it does not always work quite so well," he admitted modestly. "Luck was with me this time."
He pointed at the brass pin, explaining,
"There is a large bundle of nerve endings there, sister. What I have heard the anatomists call a plexus. If you are fortunate enough to pierce it directly, it numbs a great deal of the sensations in the lower extremity."
He straightened abruptly, realizing that he was wasting time in talk that might better be spent in action.
"Come, masseur," he ordered. "Back to your post. The action of the stimulant is not long-lasting. We must work now while the bleeding is suppressed."
Almost limp, the leg straightened easily, the splintered ends of bone drawing back through the skin. Following Monsieur Fauré's orders, I now grasped the young man about the torso while he manoeuvred the foot and lower leg so that we applied a constant traction while the final small adjustments were made.
"That will do, sister. Now, if you will but hold the foot steady for a moment..."
A shout summoned an orderly with a couple of stout sticks and some rags for binding, and in no time we had the limb neatly splinted and the open wounds firmly dressed with pressure bandages. Monsieur Fauré and I exchanged a broad smile of congratulation over the body of our patient.
"Lovely work, that," I praised,
shoving back a lock of hair that had come unbound during our exertions. I saw Monsieur Fauré's face change suddenly as he realized that I wore no veil. And just then, the loud bonging of the Vespers bell rang from the adjacent church. I glanced open-mouthed at the tall window at the end of the ward, left unglassed to allow unwholesome vapors to pass out. Sure enough, the oblong of sky was the deep half-indigo of early evening.
"Excuse me," I said, starting to wriggle out of the covering gown. "I must go at once. My husband will be worried about me coming home so late.
I'm so glad to have had the chance of assisting you, Monsieur Fauré." The tall bone-setter watched this disrobing act in patent astonishment.
"But you..." "Well, no, of course, you are not a nun. I should have realized that before. But you... who are you?"
he asked curiously. "My name's Fraser," I told him briefly. "Look, I must go, or my husband..." He drew himself up to his full gawky height and bowed with deep seriousness.
"I should esteem it a privilege if you would allow me to see you home, Madame Fraser."
"Oh! Why, thank you," I said, touched at his thoughtfulness. "I have an escort, though," I said, looking vaguely around the hall for Fergus, who had taken over escort duty from Murtaugh when he wasn't needed to steal something. He was there, leaning against the door jamb, twitching with impatience. I wondered how long he had been there. The sisters wouldn't allow him into the main hall or the wards, always insisting that he wait for me by the door. Monsieur Fauré eyed my escort dubiously, then took me firmly by the elbow.
"I will see you to your door, madame," he declared. "This section of the city is much too dangerous in the evening hours for you to be abroad with no more than a child for protection."
I could see Fergus swelling with indignation at being called a child, and hastened to protest that he was an excellent escort, always taking care to guide me by the safest streets. Monsieur Fauré paid no attention to either of us, merely nodding in a stately manner to Sister Angélique, as he steered me through the huge double doors of the hôpital. Fergus trotted at my heels, plucking at my sleeve.
"Madame," he said in an urgent whisper, "Madame, I promised the master that I would see you safely home each day, that I would not allow you to associate with undesirable..."
"Ah, here we are. Madame, you sit here. Your boy may have the other seat."
Ignoring Fergus's yapping, Monsieur Fauré picked him up and tossed him casually into the waiting carriage.
The carriage was a small open one, but elegantly equipped, with deep blue velvet seats, and a small canopy to protect the passengers from sudden inclemencies of weather, or slops flung from above. There was no coat of arms or other decoration on the equipage's door. Monsieur Foret was not of the nobility. Must be a rich bourgeois, I thought. We made polite conversation on the way home, discussing medical matters, while Fergus sulked in the corner, glowering under the ragged thatch of his hair. When we pulled up in the Rue Trimoulin, he leapt over the side without waiting for the coachman to open the door, and sprinted inside. I stared after him, wondering what ailed him, then turned to take my farewell of Monsieur Foret. "Really, it is nothing," he assured me graciously in response to my profuse thanks. "Your residence lies along the path I take to my own house, in any case, and I could not have trusted the person of such a gracious lady to the Paris streets at this hour." He handed me down from the carriage and was opening his mouth to say more when the gate slammed open behind us. I turned in time to see Jamie's expression change from mild annoyance to startled surprise. "Oh," he said. "Good evening, monsieur." He bowed to Monsieur Foret, who returned the salute with great solemnity. "Your wife has allowed me the great pleasure of delivering her safely to your door, milord. As for her late arrival, I beg you will lay the blame for that on my own shoulders. She was most nobly assisting me in a small endeavour at l'Hôpital des Anges." "I expect she was," said Jamie in a resigned tone. "After all," he added in English, raising an eyebrow at me, "you couldn't expect a mere husband to hold the same sort of appeal as an inflamed bowel or a case of bilious spots, could you?" The corner of his mouth twitched, though, and he knew he wasn't really annoyed, only concerned that I hadn't come home. I felt a twinge of regret at having worried him. Bowing once more to Monsieur Foret, he grasped me by the upper arm and hustled me through the gate. "Where's Fergus?" I asked, as soon as the gate was closed behind us. Jamie snorted.
"In the kitchen, awaiting retribution, I expect."
"Retribution? What do you mean by that?" I demanded. Unexpectedly, he laughed.
"Well," he said, "I was sitting in the study, wondering where in bloody hell you'd got to, and on the verge of going down to the hôpital myself, when the door flew open, and young Fergus shot in and threw himself on the floor at my feet, begging me to kill him on the spot."
"Kill him? Whatever for?"
"Well, that's what I asked him myself, Sassenach. I thought perhaps you and he had been waylaid by footpads along the way. There are dangerous gangs of ruffians about the streets, you ken, and I thought losing you that way would be the only thing would make him behave so. But he said you were at the gate. So I came tearing along to see were you all right, with Fergus at my heels babbling about betraying my trust and being unworthy to call me master, and begging me to beat him to death. I found it a bit difficult to think with all that going on, so I told him I'd attend to him later, and sent him to the kitchen."
"Oh, bloody hell," I said. "Does he really think he's betrayed your trust just because I've come home a bit late?" Jamie glanced aside at me.
"Aye, he does. And so he did, for that matter, letting you ride in company with a stranger. He swears that he would have thrown himself in front of the horses before he would let you enter the carriage, save that you," he added pointedly, "seemed on good terms with the man."
"Well, of course I was on good terms with him," I said indignantly. "I'd just been helping him set a leg."
"Hmm."
This line of argument appeared to strike him as unconvincing. "Oh, all right," I agreed reluctantly. "Perhaps it was a bit unwise. But he really did seem entirely respectable, and I was in a hurry to get home. I knew you'd be worried." Still, I was now wishing I had paid a little more attention to Fergus's frantic mumblings and pluckings at my sleeve. At the time, I'd been concerned only to reach home as soon as possible.
"'You aren't really going to beat him, are you?'
I asked in some alarm.
"'It wasn't his fault in the slightest. "'I insisted on going with Monsieur Foret. "'I mean, if anyone deserves beating, it's me.'
"'Turning in the direction of the kitchen, "'Jamie cocked a sardonic eyebrow at me.
"'Aye, it is,' he agreed. "'Having sworn to refrain from any such actions, though, "'I may have to settle for Fergus.'
"'Jamie, you wouldn't!'
I stopped dead, yanking on his arm.
"'Jamie, please!'
Then I saw the smile hidden in the corner of his mouth, and sighed in relief.
"'No,'
he said, letting the smile become visible.
"'I didn't mean to kill him, or even beat him for that matter. "'I may have to go clout him over the ear a time or two, though, if only to save his honour,' he added. "'He thinks he's committed a major crime by not following my orders to guard you. "'I can hardly let it pass without some sign of official displeasure.'
"'He paused outside the baize door to the kitchens to fasten his cuffs "'and rewind the stock about his throat.
"'Am I decent?' he inquired, smoothing back his thick, unruly hair. "'Perhaps I should go and fetch my coat. "'I'm not sure what's proper for administering rebukes.'
"'You look fine,' I said, suppressing a smile. "'Very severe.'
"'Oh, that's good,' he said, straightening his shoulders and compressing his lips. "'I hope I don't laugh. That wouldn't do at all,'
he muttered, pushing open the door to the kitchen stair. The atmosphere in the kitchen was far from hilarious, though. At our entrance the customary gabble ceased at once, and there was a hasty drawing up of the staff at one side of the room. Everyone stood stock still for a moment. Then there was a small stir between two kitchen maids, and Fergus stepped out into the open space before us. The boy's face was white and tracked with tears, but he wasn't weeping now. With considerable dignity he bowed, first to me, and then Jamie, in turn.
"'Madame, monsieur... "'I'm ashamed,' he said, low-voiced but distinct. "'I am unworthy to be in your employment, "'but still I beg that you will not dismiss me.'
"'His voice quavered a little at the thought, and I bit my lip. "'Fergus glanced aside at the ranks of the servants, "'as though for moral support, "'and received a nod of encouragement from Fernand, the coachman. "'Drawing a deep breath for courage, he straightened up. "'And addressed Jamie directly.
"'I am ready to suffer my punishment now, milord,' he said.
"'As though this had been the signal, "'one of the footmen stepped out of the rigid crowd, "'led the boy to the scrubbed plank table, "'and passing on the other side, "'took hold of the lad's hands, "'pulling him half across the surface of the table "'and holding him so extended.
"'But,' Jamie began, "'taken aback by the speed of events.'
He got no further before Magnus, the elderly butler, stepped gravely up and presented him with a leather strop used for sharpening the kitchen knives laid ceremoniously atop the meat platter. Jamie said, looking helplessly at me. I said, and took one step back. Eyes narrowed, he grabbed my hand, squeezing it tightly.
No, you don't, Sassenach, he muttered in English. If I have to do it, you have to watch it.
Glancing desperately back and forth between his would-be victim and the proffered instrument of execution, he hesitated for a moment longer, then gave up.
Oh, bloody fucking hell,
he muttered under his breath in English, grabbing the strop from Magnus. He flexed the broad strap dubiously between his hands. 3 inches wide and 1/4 inch thick, it was a formidable weapon. Clearly wishing himself anywhere else, he advanced upon the prone body of Fergus.
"'All right, then,' he said, glaring ferociously round the room. 10 strokes, and I don't wish to hear a fuss about it.'
Several of the female servants blanched visibly at this and clung to each other for support, but there was dead silence in the big room as he raised the strap. The resultant crack at impact made me jump, and there were small squeaks of alarm from the kitchen maids, but no sound from Fergus. The small body quivered,
and Jamie closed his eyes briefly, then set his lips, and proceeded to inflict the remainder of the sentence, strokes evenly spaced. I felt sick, and surreptitiously wiped my damp palms on my skirt.